Session number 11214, reel 3.
Colonel Jourdan, reel 3. We were talking about conditions of service in July 1916. what kind of type of food were you getting at that stage? Do you have any recollection?
No, of course, basically bully beef. And occasional, in the line itself, I would say probably bully beef all the time. I can't really remember. Remember, one was not in the line for any length of time. At the most a week, I suppose, or, which isn't very long. Well, I mean, long enough at the time, but I mean from the point of view of rations and so on. And tea, of course, in large quantities. I don't think that I can't remember what else was. Of course, once smoked a good deal then, which I suppose took the edge off one's appetite. I mean, the two things may have run
together. Have you smoked before you got out to the Western Front? Or
I smoked, yes. I always smoked Turkish cigarettes. I've never smoked Virginia cigarettes in my life. They were always solemnly sent out.
When did you started?
Smoking? I try and think of when I started at school, but it wasn't a particularly rewarding experience. I suppose at Sandhurst. Where it was not forbidden, of course.
Did you find yourself smoking more on the Western Front?
I don't know. I suppose one would only make a guess. Probably yes.
Did you find it helped calm your nerves, or did you think it helped?
I didn't think that. That I'm quite sure of. Although it might have been the case.
But that was part of the you did the restricted diet you'd had at your public school. Did that help you when it came to the bully beef diet?
The bully beef diet on the whole was better. I think I really mean that. I mean, one did not dislike the food one got at the front. I mean, it obviously wasn't very appetizing, but it could have been much worse. There were cooks somewhere other. I think the cooks were probably in the support line and brought some stuff up.
As officers, would you get any luxuries either provided or would you buy them to take them up to the front?
I was going to say such as. You see, there wasn't much you could carry.
Things like tins of fruit or...
Oh, no, I don't think so. Because it was simply a question of not being able to carry it, I think. You had a pack on your back. We, incidentally, I mean that by we, I mean that battalion, never changed our uniform into a private soldier's uniform. Now, one battalion in that brigade, the Leinsters, put all their officers into private's clothing, probably after the Battle of the Somme. The idea being, I think with some sense, that the most dangerous thing for an officer was the silhouette of his breeches. Have you been heard?
No, if you could explain it, yes.
Well, I can't.
If you could do it verbally for the tape, I know it's...
Yes, quite, yes. Anyhow, an officer's uniform, whether mounted or dismounted, consisted of jacket, breeches and puttees. And the breeches, whether you were mounted or dismounted, were, in effect, the shape, at any rate, of riding breeches. That is to say, they were like that, you know.
And they were bagged at the on the thighs.
Tight, yes. On the knees, and then bags on the side. There are plenty of photographs of me like that. And that, of course, with the officer's jacket, which came down to about here, was a very definite silhouette, or made a very clear silhouette, that bloke over there is an officer. Shoot him, I mean, or aim your thing at him. And the Leinster Regiment, which was a battalion in the same brigade, very sensibly, in a way, put all their officers into private's clothing because of this silhouette business. I'm very glad we didn't. I wouldn't have hated wearing serge and all the rest of it. But they did do that.
Why would you have hated it? I mean, just because of the feel of the cloth? Or?
Partly snob and partly the feel of the cloth. And, of course, high collars. You know, buttoned up to here. And ours were like that.
So you just felt restricted? affected at the neck.
Yes, and probably a lot of scratching and itching and that sort of thing.
What about the webbing? Did you carry on?
I never, because I wasn't in the front line much after that, I never actually wore webbing. I hated the stuff, but people did.
Why did you dislike webbing?
Partly snob. I was very fond of my Sam Brown belt. I thought I looked much nicer in the Sam Brown belt than in webbing. And but people did wear webbing, and sometimes they... But only really to carry bombs or something in it, because there's no particular point in wearing webbing as such. I mean, it didn't alter the silhouette. It's the silhouette that mattered.
What about marks of rank on the uniform?
Well, when I started life, they were always here. By the time I went to France, two of us, we thought our uniforms were always very natty. We started this idea of putting them up here, which was creeping in, but it was still officially down here.
On the braid,
in a bracket sort of thing, and rings round for different ranks. And from about 1979 on, a chap called Dennis Wickham always went about with gilt stars up here, and we thought we looked much nicer. We were very... not proud, but... fussy about our uniforms and the appearance and that kind of thing when we were out of the line. We even once went to Paris.
I'll come back.
That'll come later.
We dealt with food. What about? Did you have a servant in the line?
Always. Always had a servant somewhere or other. We didn't the date after, but there was a chap. I had him for ages. I mean, in the line, and that was a very... I don't know, it's a very curious relationship. The chaps who had the servants never resented it. They were always very loyal and extremely helpful. By helpful, I mean in looking after one's belongings and so on.
So what exactly would they do for you?
In the line, not much, except probably get your food for you if you were not in a position to go and sit down with other people, you know, and that sort of thing. Very little in the line, except that, and look after your uniform, so forth, out of it.
Do you think you had an easier life as an officer than the private soldiers did in the line? Were conditions just marginally
better? And of course, there's one. You see, I mean, your batman was there somewhere too. I'd forgotten that. Not that he could do a great deal, but he was there. And he probably had something to do with either the cooking of and. Handling the food. I mean, the food might have to come to you a little way up the line, that sort of thing. But this chap was always there.
What about the latrines and such like? What provision for that was there in the front line?
Officers and other ranks. And a little... I can't remember quite where they were, but I suppose they went fractionally back from the front of the line.
And you had separate officers' facilities?
Yeah.
Were they fairly crude?
Fairly crude, but of course, even out of the line, it was all fairly crude. Because I mean, you were in sort of camps. I mean, even in a village and so forth. And the first thing that happened was, you remember, each infantry battalion had a pioneer section, and the pioneers had two very important jobs: one to put up latrines wherever you went to, and the other one was to bury the dead.
Did you have any other health problems while you were during this first month or so in the line at Loos, other than the trench fever we've already...
No, only the, I suppose, the overwhelming desire to sleep at night.
You mentioned this before. You fell asleep, you say, once. What actually happened? Could you tell us that story? I mean...
Well, it's quite simple. I mean, I'm in the front line. I'm on duty, but I'm simply there as a body, standing up. And, of course, you couldn't literally look over the parapet, though sometimes you could. And you were either awake or asleep. You might be asleep. And I was caught being asleep once, you see. And you had no control over it. I mean, as a still a pretty young boy, I suppose, the fact that you'd been awake for the previous, let's say, 18 hours or something of that sort, sleep just knocked you out. Because you couldn't... It isn't as if you could march up and down like that. You might be able to move a little distance along the trench, but then it meant disturbing other chaps and all that. You tended to stay in one place, and staying in one place occasionally looking over the top, nothing much to see except barbed wire, and feeling drowsy, you could go to sleep standing up, I mean.
What did he say, your company commander, when he caught you? I mean, what was his attitude?
Oh, it was pretty wild, I think. We didn't go off the handle too much, because I suppose it happened quite a lot of times. The point is, I suppose theoretically, you could have been court-martialed and shot for it. You needn't put that down. But it's for anybody who's young, or was young, it was very difficult not to, I suppose. Because it isn't as if you could even march up and down all the time.
Would the privates, the men, would they have dugouts as well, or would they be sleeping on the...
They would be sleeping mostly, I think, on the fire step. Because they were theoretically on the front line.
And that's why you couldn't go up and down?
No, you couldn't. I mean, the trenches were very difficult things to navigate.
That would be your job, just standing there when you were on night duty. Would you have to check that the sentries were awake?
Well, yes, I suppose you probably did. I suppose that's quite true.
Were there any other duties you were ever put on at night, such as wiring parties or...?
I didn't. A lot of people did. The wiring parties, of course, were fairly common, but it so happens that the wire in front of Loos was pretty solid. And you see, the Battle of Loos had taken place in September 1915, and we're now talking about a year later, isn't it? Yes, about a year later. And anyway, all the wire had been repaired, so there's only occasional local repairs. And, of course, occasional, I didn't get sent out on them, sort of recce parties through the wire to try... The great thing in those days was to get a German prisoner. The idea being, if you got a German prisoner, you got an identification. That was the word. You probably heard it hundreds of times. I did not get sent on any of those. I was very glad at the time I wasn't. And it was a chancy business. It had probably been an officer and two other ranks going out and trying to nab Germans doing much the same thing on the other. They were very close, remember. I mean, certainly closer than those houses down there.
Yeah, 200 yards or 200 to 300. So, if you weren't on this business of being in the trench, right, the frontline trench, actually on duty, you would be sleeping, I presume, then?
Well, if you win, I suppose if you win the line, we'll say, for about a week, not more, I should think, you were probably the same every night, because, I mean, you've got the same men, the same number of duties and so on, and the same amount of supervision. And I don't know, probably... I can't remember this very accurately, but obviously you couldn't be awake night after night after night for 7 nights. It would probably split between up to midnight and after midnight or something between 2 officers. Because, I mean, any company would have anything from 3 to 4 officers in it. Yes, I suppose that's what it was.
And what would your daytime duties be as a junior soldier?
I nearly said damn all, but... I suppose for some reason or other, a certain amount of clerical work to be done. Keeping the troops' morale up, I suppose you'd say. I mean,
how did you go about that? You see what I mean?
Talking to the men, saying whatever the equivalent was of high in those days, letting them know that you were there and that if there's any bother, you will take charge and so forth. And if they had any minor bothers, they probably would tell you. In a platoon was nominally 50 men or something like that, but it was usually much smaller than that, and they were your lot. And you were fairly, after a time, you see, I mean, I come out to the front, we say, on the first of the month. By the middle of the month, I begin to know the people in my platoon fairly well, and I think it was rather that. Irish troops, of course, are rather different to British troops. I mean, they consider the officer was... there by divine right and so on, and
what would always you talk to them about? I mean, besides what? Greeting them, what would you talk to them about? Their backgrounds or?
No, I don't know what I'm talking about backgrounds. They usually had something to say to you, because some of them were looking over the parapet at certain times and seeing things rather bravely. I don't know whether they thought the officers were necessary evils or not, but I think a platoon, which was really the smallest unit, wasn't it? It was a unit which had an entity, either liked or disliked its officer, I know of one case where it was the company commander, I'm pretty sure, was shot in the back. Because he wasn't, because he'd been much too rough.
What makes you think, what makes you so sure he was shot in the back, if you see what I mean?
Because I was told so at the time, I suppose. I didn't see it.
And that was when?
That was later on. I think it was in 1917.
We might come back to that.
But not the Battle of the Somme, but in some political. Because I'm quite sure that if an officer were unfair or anything like rough or something, and men, particularly with Irish troops, they wouldn't forget it.
But you were reasonably popular with your platoon.
Well, I was not unpopular, I think. Provided you treated the men, you see, Irish troops are a bit different to English troops. They've got, in a way, less individuality, I suppose. But I never felt I had any difficulty with them at all. I hope that doesn't sound pompous.
How about the actual day-to-day thing? You mentioned the shelling your reaction to it. You described that they had, the Germans occasionally started bombardments.
Yes.
How common were they? Were these very common?
Well, if you were in the line for a week, you might expect that once or twice. I should say, I'm a bit vague about memory, but it was very alarming while it happened, of course. Because, I mean, there were bloody great shells, 5.9s, 5.9 howitzer shells, which, of course, were doing that. And there was always a possibility they might happen to drop one in the line. It very seldom happened.
What about German mortars? Were they?
They were trying, yes, I've forgotten them. They were very unpleasant things. Because they go up into the sky. I never remember seeing them, but people could see them. They're very slow-moving things. Go up in the sky and come down like that, and you could see them coming down and run away, in a sense.
What about sniping? Was that, you were quite close to the German lines. Was it a risk?
Most battalions had, I don't know, a few snipers who found particular places where they could just see. But it never amounted to anything very much. All it did do, the fact that both sides had them, meant that you were pretty careful not to put your head above the parapet, because you will look over there and see nothing. But there's a gentleman over there who's drawn a bead on you, and before you knew it, you were shot. So, I mean, you didn't go looking over the parapet in daylight, anyway.
Did you suffer casualties from sniping?
I think so, yes. I mean, not large numbers, of course, but occasional ones. Because that's what the snipers on either side were there for.
What about general small arms fire, you know, machine guns and just general rifle fire, as opposed to aimed sniping fire? Was there much...
Sniping was much more to be feared, because no machine guns or rifle fire could go into a trench, nor could a sniper shoot into a trench, but if he could catch somebody, probably one of his own kind, looking through a loophole or something, get him shot. But occasionally, it's the shells that are the things that frighten one most, because the shells were doing, the howitzers and doing that, and all the rifle fire was, roughly speaking, horizontal.
You mentioned the mine activity, you know, the mining the Germans were doing. Well, did anything happen while you were there at all?
No, I never had a mine going up under... I don't know if you ever looked at a trench map of that part of the world, loose. One massive mine craters. One never went up in our section of the line at Loos in the time I was there. On part of the divisional front, I think they did, and some of the trench maps there, simply one mass of mine explosions.
Did it prey on your mind at all, the knowledge that they were working underneath you?
I don't think so. I don't know why it shouldn't, because, I mean, it was real, all right. I don't think it ever went up.
What about British mining? Was there any...
Oh, I think so, but one didn't know. They were, sappers and miners, but it was an RE job, and possibly with infantry help to dig.
But they weren't actually digging in your sector then?
Not that I know of. They might have been. They might have been. I mean, it'll come later, but at the marine show, I went up a mine shaft, a horizontal mine shaft from our side, which our people had dug.
So that was life in the line. Did you find the stress and the fatigue getting to you at all during that early phase? It was your first time in action. You were only 18. Did it have any effect on your nerve?
No, I was, I imagine, trying to look at it dispassionately, a very frightened little boy. But at the same time, he was not going to show it, which is possible. End of story, is it?
So, what about the morale of the men?
That's a question. They always appear to be perfectly... not regardless of the danger, but and certainly not unconscious of the danger, but taking it all in the day's work. I mean, it was normal to be in the line for a week or 10 days or something, and to be out of it. And if you happen to get a shell dropping in, well, that's your bad luck. But otherwise, it wasn't too bad. I mean, that was, one would imagine, was what they were thinking.
So they were quite fatalistic about it.
Yes, I should think so, yes.
What about when
you never thought about Germans very much.
What about when you were out of the line? What would you do then?
Nothing very much. I mean, just that rather brief period was a lot of things like bathing, in the sense that Mazengarbe or Nerlemien, there was a factory there which had a bathing pool, and of course that was a godsend, and the troops all got a good bath.
Did you have a problem with lice amongst the troops, or the officers, or yourself?
I think they did, but I never did. My God, I'd have gone bonkers if I had. I never had, I never had any of those things, and did.
Did you take any special precautions,
No.
Or do you put it down to any reason that you didn't get them?
No. I'd been shattered of a head. There wasn't much of it at Loos. Week in, without, sort of week in, week out. There wasn't much. Because in that particular bit, and that's only really the only bit I knew in close detail, people, when they were out, which might have been 1 week in the line, one in support, one out, there was bathing, and so they were fairly clean.
Would you do any training while you were out of the line?
Not if you had a decent commanding officer, I think. I mean, some of the regular battalions, there was a regular battalion of the Munster Fusiliers, and I think they had a fairly rough time doing that sort of thing when you're out. You see, when you're out, people really wanted a rest.
Was your battalion a battalion that would insist on polishing buttons again and things like that when you're out of the line, and re-establishing that sense of spit and polish?
That's very interesting. I can't remember. This needn't go down, but I mean, it'll come later. Later on, in the middle of the Battle of the Somme, we got a guard's CO planted on us, and the guards made a point of never cleaning their buttons, in or out of the line. Never mind, that came later on.
So that doesn't strike you as...
I think they probably did clean them as a matter of discipline, self-respect, and all those kind of things, because they'd soon get dull again, wouldn't they?
Would you go to the... when you were out, would you have any opportunity to go to local estaminets or
I think so. I didn't, in fact, I don't think. But I think it was a populated area there. In some places, of course, it wasn't.
Why didn't you go? Did you not like sort of that sort of thing? Or?
I didn't like that kind of thing, but I preferred to... one drank a certain amount, but drank in the mess. I don't think there was a great deal of it. There was a certain amount. I mean, oddly enough, I can remember being billeted, if the battalion were here, being billeted in a cottage about a mile over there, and walking to and from meals, but simply because there wasn't much accommodation. No, I don't think so.
When you went down to the Somme, were you aware that this was of what was going on at the Somme? Did you know about the...
Before
you got there?
Well... we're talking about July 1916, that's not when the Somme began, and when I went to Loos, you could hear it. I think you could hear it here, for that matter, but still, you could hear it going on, and you wondered. And then when you got down there, the closer you got to the front line, this infernal noise became appalling, and it never stopped. That I have never forgotten. This appalling bombardment, 24 hours a day. The noise and the, not so much the shells landing and so on, but simply the infernal noise, because You've got guns over miles and miles and miles of the front, going on 24 hours a day, and it drove you nearly bonkers in itself. You could never get away from it, of course. And I think that at the time, and for some time afterwards, I remembered very vividly. Whether one had shell shock as a result, I don't know. If you weren't in the line in the ordinary sense. We weren't, at least I wasn't in the line in the ordinary sense. I came back out of, I'd been in hospital for a week or whatever it was. I came back on the night of the battle, may come later, the Battle of Guillemont, after I was arrived at the base lines, which are the transport lines, and they said, you go up to the front, you see. And so I went up. And the going up was perfectly appalling. You went through miles and miles of woods which were being bombarded and hadn't all been knocked down then. Shells arriving all the time, this infernal din. Eventually got up there, and the battalion had a hiding in this Battle of Guillemont, and we were sent up as reinforcements, really. And when we got there, they said, we don't want you. We've got enough here. We've had our belly full. We don't want any new boys, but you can go back. And that was even worse, because we had to go through this appalling area which was being bombarded morning, noon and night. It was all like that, this terrifying noise, terrifying, I suppose, is the word. And then one was knocking about for about, I suppose we were out for about a week. The commanding officer had been killed, the second in command had been killed, various other people had been killed, and we were sort of reforming under a new CO, a guards officer, who had been, as they were in France, a whole lot of senior majors lying about, recording a senior majors list, who were, if a commanding officer got killed, they sent him out, not regardless of his regiment. And we got this chap. I'm out of phase, aren't I, talking about that?
You're fine.
I got this certain Colonel Fielding, then a major, an elderly gent in the Coldstream Guards, who was not a regular soldier, but a nice man, but he was a Roman Catholic. And they thought, send him to the Connaught Rangers. They've just lost their commanding officer. So Fielding turned up as a very large, rubicund man, and that was between the Battle of Guillemont and the Battle of the Ginchy. And I was, I forget, a intelligence officer or something, and we went up for Ginchy, and Ginchy was another very unpleasant experience, and in the middle of the Battle of Ginchy, I was by then the signal officer of the battalion. The adjutant went sick, which is not a very good thing for an adjutant to do in the middle of what was virtually a battle. And Fielding, who took a certain liking to me, said, thou shalt be adjutant. And I was about, military speaking, about that high. And so I was duly taken on as adjutant. And this all belongs to a later phase.
Right. Just stepping back a little bit to the Battle of Ginchy, then. What exactly happened then? Could you take me through what happened?
All I knew was there's going to be a battle tomorrow afternoon. We are going to go over the top tomorrow afternoon. You, FWSJ, are the signal officer. And that didn't mean very much to me one way or the other. When the battle started, it was all very horrifying, and the shells were shooting over the trench and knocking the sand off the parapet. The troops went forward, and they very soon came back. They were knocked out, they were really knocked to bits by the Germans. I did not take part in the actual movement, because it wasn't my business to do so. I was a signal officer, and I was there in the front-line trench.
What were you doing? What was your role?
Looking after whatever signal communications there were. You see, D3 telephones and things like that, and lines which kept on being broken.
Did you send signal as a forward?
Trying to go back, you see. No, really, I don't think any... You see, forward was only a matter of hundreds of yards. It was almost within shouting distance. It was the only useful communication, or could have been, was back to brigade. And then...
So who do you have with you?
One or two NCOs and soldiers.
Signalers.
Trying to keep a line going down the communication trench to the next step back. And of course that kept on being bombarded and the things being cut. And several brave men kept on mending it, because it was a very